All right, I always feel strange in a ladies' Bible study. The only one with a tie on. Okay, cowboy goes into church, very sophisticated church. He's got his old jeans and his old shirt and his old stained hat and his muddy boots. Preacher looks down, sees him, and goes, not fitting in here real well. So he lets him come two or three Sundays, and finally he meets him after church, and he goes, partner, I think you need to consult with the Lord about what you're wearing to church. Cowboy said, well, you know what? I will do that. So he came back the next Sunday, looked exactly the same. Preacher met him after church and said, I thought you were going to talk to the Lord about what you were wearing to church. He said, pastor, I did talk to the Lord about what I was wearing to church, and he said it was okay because he'd never been to this church. Okay, this morning, I'm not sure where he got his revelation from, but we're going to go from mousetraps to irreducible complexity to a video to an overhead. So stay tuned, all right? We're going to fly. We're going to talk a little bit and just kind of hit some highlights of what's called intelligent design. Anybody ever heard of intelligent design? ID? Okay. There is a real issue that's going around our nation right now. In fact, a whole school board in Kansas was kicked out over this issue. It is coming up around the country in a number of different ways. And I want to kind of delineate for you what it means, because some people feel like it's just a Christian answer to evolution, and it's really not. It works out that way in the end, but that's not the primary purpose when you talk about intelligent design. And the reason you don't have notes is, well, I'm going to be all over the place. So if you want to write something down, fine. If you want to just sit and watch, that's fine too. So I'm going to use the overhead in a little bit, and then I'm going to move the overhead, and we're going to actually watch about half of a video or a DVD on, well, I'll tell you when we get there, okay? So let's pray. Father, thank you for this time together. Thank you for Lydia and the ladies leading us in worship. Thank you for the opportunity to share your word, and Lord, to just look into, Father, the reality of life and the way that you made it. Father, bless our minds together today as we think about the greatness and the goodness of God. In Jesus' name, amen. You all know that Sherry is in, right? Is in Arcadia and an accreditation team. I was on one last week at Yorba Linda Friends Christian. And what you do is you go on Sunday afternoon and you meet with the principals and they walk you through the whole school. And the school that I was at had two schools. So we walked for 2.5 hours through every room in every school. They were in two different locations. And so Sherry's up at one in Arcadia. So that's what you do. And then usually that night you have a dinner with the board of the school and you get to know them and you ask them some questions. And then Monday morning, before you get to this, however, what you have to do is they assign each, there are usually five or six of you that go, and they assign you sections in this accreditation document that you need to read. And actually, an accreditation document is usually that thick. So all the members have to read the whole thing first. And then you go through, whether it's math or transportation or health issues or school, home, community or philosophy and goals or the board or whatever. They assign you about four or five sections, and you go through that section and you write three commendations, three recommendations, just from what you see on the paper about what you think are good things and things that might need to be different according to the standards that ACSI has set. So you get that ready, you ship that to the team leader, which is what Sherry is, and then they start putting that document together before you ever get together. Then Monday morning, you go through the school and you start looking for all your sections for your recommendations and commendations and see if you were right, because you might have made a recommendation that they're already doing but they didn't say in the document, or you might find something else that according to the standard needed to be different or changed or challenged or whatever. So you do that all day Monday. Then Monday night, you usually have, and Monday afternoon, you're either having dinner with parents or you're having dinner with or lunch with the kids or whatever. So it's all day, boom, 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 boom. And then Monday night, you get together, and we got together at 7 o'clock at night and worked till 11, and you work on the document and you start working through those sections and say, is this true, is this not true, do I need to change this? And you go through all the wording and everything. Tuesday, you get up and you go back and do the same thing. By Tuesday afternoon, you pretty well have the document read or written. And then Tuesday afternoon or Tuesday night, you start going through it and you start fine-tuning it. Really look at the grammar. Is this true? Isn't this true? Does this need to be in here? And then you start picking the four major recommendations and the four major commendations, or five or six commendations, but usually only four recommendations, and that are the big ones you want to highlight. And then the rest are small. And then by Tuesday night, you've written the whole thing. On Wednesday, You just double check real quick. You hand it to the secretary. She's been typing the whole time you're there. When she gets done typing, about noon, you take that document and you take the administrators in a room and you read the whole thing to them, section at a time. And they can sit and argue back and forth. I don't think this is true. I think you should add this. Did you look at this? And, you know, and you go back and forth. And it's very, usually very amenable because you're trying to help the school even be better, realizing that at one point in time, some of those people will be at your school. So you'd be very nice to them. So you read the whole thing to them. Then you put any corrections together, give it back to the secretary. Then right after school that day, you read this entire document to the staff. So you get the whole staff in there, every teacher, administrator, everything. And you read the whole thing, recommendations, commendations, and then you just say goodbye, and then you're gone. So that's a long, lengthy process, and it's a good one. It helps you to be a better school. We'll go through that again in 3 years. So there's a six-year term is the most you can get, and that's what Stony Brook has. So we'll do that in 3 more years. And it takes you a year to actually write your document. So we'll start in 2 years writing the document for the visit in 3 years. So it's a lot of work. So that explains why Sherry's not here. Whew. What's that? I don't know if they recorded a game. I don't know if she wants to see the game. When she was at the banquet Saturday night, you noticed that little earpiece, right? Uh-huh. She was listening to UCLA game. All right. Intelligent design. The theory of intelligent design holds that certain features of the universe and of living things are best explained by an intelligent cause rather than an undirected process such as natural selection. In other words, God made the universe to be discovered by man, and that is an awesome thing, so that we can know what cells look like, we can know what the universe looks like in some areas, and the Hubble Space Telescope and microscopes and all kinds of things. But God made us the world so that man could discover what's there. And that's the awesome part about it. And, of course, you know, you have Darwinism on one side, or evolutionary thought, that says it's all random chance and this thing just came together by natural selection, which is kind of amazing in itself. But we'll talk about that as we go along. In a broader sense, intelligent design is a... let me go back. Intelligent design is thus a scientific disagreement. Now, notice that. In scientific disagreement, not a religious disagreement, but a scientific. And let me explain that to you. Long time ago, we're living in a postmodern society where there are two levels of upper level, lower level. Let's just call them that for right now. In the lower level, the world wants to put facts and science down here, okay? And up here on the top, they want to put value or what you believe to be true. Now, in a postmodern society where you have relativism, what you believe up here doesn't affect what's fact down here, which is why religion or Christianity has been so much diminished over the years, because it's been relegated to this upper story of, if that's what you want to believe, that's fine, but it's not true and it's not factual and it's not in reality. You can't make it true. Only science can make that happen. But what's happened is, in a postmodern world, even science has lost its power, till today what the colleges and high schools are teaching is that you construct your own reality down here. So if you think it's true and you want it to be true, then it's true. Which is why some in our country didn't say it was evil for the guys to fly the planes into the Twin Towers. Why? Because that was their reality of what was true. And that's what they believed to be true, so it must be true for them. Which leads to all kinds of complications that we'll talk about today. But you have to know that before you start, that Christianity has been relegated to this upper realm. And it's because of our own doing. And that's where men like William Dembski and D.A. Carson and J.P. Moreland and those guys have tried to take us in apologetics to understand and to help the world understand that Christianity answers all of those things. If you have a Christian worldview, you're looking at three different topics. Number one, creation. Number two, fall. And number three, redemption. And all world systems, even evolution, have to answer those three questions. And evolution will do that, and you can probably figure out how to do that with evolution. But they have to answer those three questions, and that is a Christian worldview. Creationism, the fall, and redemption. Either it was started by random chance or God created. It's got to be one or the other. Or if somebody came from outer space and deposited man here, which one of the founders, or not the founders, the discoverers of DNA really believes that life on Earth started from a spaceship coming from another planet. Another one said, major scientist in the United States said, evolution was disproved 100 years ago. The only other plausible explanation is God created. However, I choose to believe that evolution is true. Because you have, if you prove that evolution is wrong and creationism is true, then you have to answer to the one who created. So materialists or naturalists will want to always stay in that natural realm, because then they're going to have to deal with a creator if they don't. And will at times, and I won't go through that today, but I have sections in a book that actually show you illustrations that are in science textbooks in the United States today that have been proved false like 20 years ago, where they glued these little moths on a tree and took a picture of it, and it's in science books. I've seen one before, and they didn't tell you they glued them on the tree. They said, look, these moths, pepper moths, morphed into something else other than, you know, a pepper moth as it clung to this tree. And they actually know they glued them on the tree now. But it's still in books. And another guy took some embryonic stages of animals and man and totally changed the second stage and made them look like they were all the same. And somebody later on went, wait a minute, that's not what they look like. But it's still in textbooks. So there are some very falsifiable concepts out there that are floating around. Anyway, intelligent design. In a broader sense, intelligent design is simply the science of design detection, how to recognize patterns arranged by an intelligent cause for a purpose. Design detection is used in a number of scientific fields, such as anthropology, forensic sciences, that seek to explain the cause of events such as death or fire, cryptanalysis, and the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, called CD, search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Now, I want you to think about that for a minute. We have these big, huge telescopes that are probably as big as this auditorium, pointed at the sky. What are they listening for? ET phone home, yes. What are they listening for? You got to come up with something. What do they think they're going to hear? Signals. Okay. They think they're going to hear, and this is actually a science, okay? And I mean, millions of dollars is spent on SETI science, SETI. Listening for signals from outer space that prove there's intelligent life out there. How are they going to prove by the data that it's intelligent life? What's that? Now, there's a way. If you could prove it was intelligent life, how would you do it? Regina? Exactly. There's going to be an organized signal that sends data in some manner, right? Okay. Have they ever found it? No. So, the explanation of that is this, though. In order to determine intelligence, you have to have data that's designed to transmit the intelligence, right? Okay, take a sentence. If you just throw letters out there, I mean, I could just do that in kindergarten, just let them spell anything they wanted to, right? And you wouldn't be able to read most of it. They would just throw letters out there. But intelligent design says, if I put T-H-E, that means that I can begin to read that. It's an intelligent way to communicate. So our own scientific community says we're going to set up this multi-million, bazillion-dollar big antennas that are sucking in all of this noise from space, and the only way we can tell is intelligent is if in some way it's organized into a data system. Now, if that's true, then why is an intelligent design true? How can you take random nothing chance and turn it into organized data and say there was no intelligent thing behind it? Does that make sense to you? Okay, good. Next one. Intelligent design is controversial because of the implications of its evidence rather than the significant weight of its evidence. the implication of its evidence rather than the significant weight of its evidence. In other words, you don't have to have this huge preponderance of evidence, which there is in intelligent design, to prove it's there. But what the problem is the perspective that if it's really true or even you think it's true, then your whole mindset has to be changed and your whole way of thinking. And evolution is a religion, by the way. Okay? Has a whole belief system. Can't be proved. Right? By the three scientific methods, it's not reproducible, it's not observable, it's not measurable. You can't do any of the three with evolution. So how can you say it's true if you can't do those things with it? Which is why it's really a theory, but some don't want to call it a theory. They live by that. William Dembski. Anybody ever heard of William Dembski? Okay. He's a handsome guy. He looks like that right there. He's a mathematician and philosopher. He taught at Northwestern University, University of Notre Dame, University of Dallas. He's done postdoctoral work in mathematics at MIT, physics at the University of Chicago, computer science at Princeton University. He is a very smart man. He said, intelligent design has no prior religious commitments and interprets the data of science on generally accepted scientific principles. Okay? So intelligent design doesn't start out with creator. Intelligent design says, something made this. And we want to get to the truth. And that's really the bottom line of all of this is, do you really want to know the truth? And what is truth? Can I prove it? Can I show it to you? Or are you starting with a mindset that already says that I'm going to accept this over here because I don't want to accept this over here? Or are we just going to put the information together and then see where it leads us? In particular, intelligent design does not depend on the biblical account of creation. Now, don't go, that's not biblical. Okay? It doesn't depend on that because we're not starting from a biblical point of view. We want to start from a scientific point of view. If you want to talk to scientists, you start from a scientific point of view and let it go. Now, am I worried about it? No. Why? God made the universe. They're not going to find anything in this world that will ever prove there's not a God or that he didn't create it. So, put that way over here and just park it. And just say, I don't even need a Bible. I don't even have one this morning. And we're talking about intelligent design and creation. So take the Bible, put it way over there. Now, I don't care if you believe in the 24-hour day theory, and when I was here in another Bible study, I explained these, 24-hour day or day age, where each day in the book of Genesis was thousands and maybe millions of years, or the scheme type where there was actually God just laid it out in Genesis and it just kind of gave us what it might look like, but we really don't know how he put it together kind of thing. So I don't care which of those three views you hold. It does not matter. Just put it right over here and just say, let's see where science takes us. Intelligent design begins with data that scientists observe in the laboratory and nature identifies them in patterns known to signal intelligent causes and thereby ascertains whether a phenomenon was designed. For design theorists, the conclusion of design constitutes an inference from data, not a deduction from a religious authority. In other words, if you're looking at how did God design, we're looking at an inference from data. What does the data say? Not what did God say in the book of Genesis. Okay? Because if you just say, well, the Bible says, you have circular reasoning. It just goes like this. Why? Because God said. How do I know? Because God said. That doesn't get you anywhere. Well, what does science say over here? Science will always prove the Bible. I never have to worry about that never happening. But I never say that the Bible has to agree with science. I always say science has to agree with the Bible. There's a big difference. All right. The Kalam cosmological argument. Anybody heard of the Kalam cosmological argument? Good. You're about to see it. Here it is right here. The Kalam cosmological argument has its roots in medieval Arabic philosophy and theology. The Arabic word Kalam means speech. But more broadly, it means natural theology or philosophical theism. The distinctive feature of this, and we're going to look at it here, this is called the Kalam cosmological argument, okay? Which was about 800, I think, they came up with this. You have to go through three sections here, or three different steps, to get to where you want to be. Put simply, Kalam argument tries to demonstrate, one, that the existence of an actual infinite is, well, let's not do that yet. Okay, in the Kalam cosmological argument, there are three steps. At the top, either the universe and everything that we see had a beginning, or it had no beginning. You have to choose one of those two. Okay, there's nothing else. You have to choose, because you can't take something out of nothing, right? Only God can do that. So, even an evolutionist has to come up with something. And either it had a beginning, and we know that once that all of the stars and everything in space is moving away from a center at a determined rate that is slowing down, right? Yes. So, it is moving at a rate, and it is slowing down. Stars are getting older like our sun, and in 200 million years or whatever it is, the sun will burn out. So, we know that there is aging going on in the universe, and it is moving away, and radiation, levels of radiation are changing as the world gets, or the universe gets older. So, it has to either have a beginning or no beginning. If it has a beginning, then it was caused. You can't have what's called an uncaused cause. Right? Or an unmoved mover. You can't say that it was just sitting there. Let's take evolution for a minute. Okay, all of those gases or whatever was there that were not created by anybody were sitting there, and all of a sudden they went and exploded. Okay? All right, but what made them explode? So now you have an unmoved mover. If God didn't create and go and throw everything into space at exactly the right speed, and by the way, do you know if the Big Bang is true, which it may be, and if God created that way, that Big Bang was so technical that it had to be at the exact right speed for things to have been created, or it would have been burned up and gone too fast, or it would have been sucked back in to the nucleus. So it had to go exactly at the right speed. And I'm getting way behind. We got to go. All right. So, it's either beginning or no beginning, caused or uncaused. It's either personal or impersonal. It has to be either one of those. It has to be either one of these. So, you have a beginning that was caused and it's personal, or you have no beginning that was uncaused and it's impersonal. Everybody with me so far? Okay. This real, and I'm not going to get into this because I am not a mathematician, but it actually proves there is no infinity. Now, there could be an infinite number of a set, like numbers, or books in the library, or hotel rooms, okay? Those are a set. There can be an infinite number because you can always add one to it. But God is not infinite. I mean, the universe is not infinite, okay? Yes, let's go this way. The universe is not infinite. And God is infinite. So the universe has parameters. Now, we can't see them. And here's one thing that I find really fascinating. If you go to listen to some scientists talk, they will talk about the possibility of other universes, proving that the mathematical probability of this universe happening actually proves that this universe could happen, because the fact that this universe happened is 10 to the 40,000th exponent to 1 that it could ever happen like this. So what they say is, well, there could be other universes that have tried to exist, and so this is just one of those. But how can you argue from something that we don't even know is true? We have no proof that there are other universes, so how can you say that the mathematical calculation could be true if there were enough universes being built somewhere? All right, do you see the length that scientists will go to try and prove that there was no designer in this? And here's the other side too. There are some scientists who say there is design, but it was built in the beginning just by the forces that were there. Okay, so which one of you has ever found a watch on the ground and said, wonder how this got here? Right? Or tried to put a 740 to get 7 together in a junkyard. It doesn't make sense. Okay, let's keep going. So, Kalam's cosmological argument. The universe either had a beginning or no beginning. If it had a beginning, there was either cause or uncaused. If it had a cause, there was either personal or not personal. One of the three. What are the implications of the world with no beginning, no apparent cause for its existence, and no personal creator? Why are you here? Why do you go to school? Why do you live a good life? Is there really anything good in this world? Okay, you have to answer all those questions. Next one. There is a book called Total Truth, and I've got it right here, and it's written by Nancy Piercy. By Nancy Piercy. She helped Chuck Colson write the other book that he wrote called How Now Should We Then Live. And in this book, she's covering some information about cells. All right? About cells. So we want to talk about cells for just a minute. Darwin thought that cells were extremely simple, nothing but a bubble of jelly or protoplasm. Over the past few decades, however, new technologies like the electron microscope have produced a revolution in molecular biology. We know that the cell bristles with high-tech molecular machinery far more complex than anything devised by mere humans. Now we're talking about cells in your body. Each cell is akin to a miniature factory town, humming with power plants, automated factories, and recycling centers. And the nucleus is a cellular library, housing blueprints and plans that are copied and transported to factories, each of which is filled with molecular machines that function like computerized motors. These manufacture the immense array of products needed within the cell, and the process all regulated by the enzymes that function as stopwatchers to ensure that everything is perfectly timed. Now, can you believe all that goes on inside each cell of your body? The cell is thus a minute factory bristling with rapid, organized chemical activity. Nature invented the assembly line some billions of years before Henry Ford. The outside surface of the cell is studded with sensors, gates, pumps, identification markers to regulate traffic coming in and out. Today, biologists cannot even describe the cell without resorting to the language of machines and engineering. Here's what one looks like. A structure within a cell. Now, there are bazillions of those in your body, and it says like the hook, universal joint, it has a filament, which is a propeller. It has an S ring, an M ring, a rotor, a stator. It looks just like something that turns and makes electricity. And there are millions of those in your body. Now, in order for that to be formed a part at a time, it would never work because that particular piece right there, structure, you cannot take one piece away from it and have it function. Not one. So it would have to have been made in its entirety all at once to work and function. So how could it have evolved? All right? So can you imagine all that stuff going on in the cells in your body? Now, that's called irreducible complexity. Irreducible complexity. Here's a great example of irreducible complexity right here. By the way, I didn't catch a mouse in this, okay? This is a mouse trap. Which part of this can I take off and still have a functional mouse trap? There's no cheese on there. Okay, on the device itself. Not trying to enhance it. Okay. The paint, but I still have a mousetrap, right? If I take anything other than this little, well, that hook's got to be on there too. Anything off of there, I do not have a functioning mousetrap. That is called irreducible complexity. You can only reduce the complexity of this to a point, and then you have to say that's as far as you can go to have a functioning device. And the same thing is true in your body and with cell structures. It can only be reduced so far, and that's it. And your cells differ from cell structure in animals. So how can there be so many different cell structures going on and different things inside your body if it wasn't planned? All right, next one. We got to keep going because I have lots of good stuff to share with you. Argument from a transcendental moral law. Is it ever right to kill babies, to torture babies for fun? No, you and I would sit there and go, ah. But if it's never right, was it right 3,000 years ago? No. Was it right 1,000 years ago? No. Is it okay in a Persian Empire? No. Is it okay in a Chinese, under Chinese government? No. It is never right to torture babies for fun. Never. Who said? Well, society said, Don't think so. There are some things that are right and some things that are wrong, and they're always, it's called transcendental morality. It is always wrong to do these things. Always. And where did that come from? People all over the world experience guilt and shame. I don't care what culture you step into. Even in South America, with the Akua Indians, they experience guilt and shame. And they hadn't seen a white man in 1950 when Nick Saint and those guys went down there. So there are some transcendental moral laws that permeate our society that say these things are good, these things are not good. When those guys flew those planes into the Twin Towers, we all went, "Ah, that's horrible." Why? Because there is a transcendental moral law that says that's good, that's not. If you have a moral law, you must have a moral lawgiver. Otherwise, it doesn't matter. Then you live in relativism. If you ever come upon somebody who wants to really argue that point, walk out with their stereo. And they go, "Where are you going?" "I'm taking your stereo." "Why?" "Because I want it." "Well, it's mine." "So? To me, this is right. I can take your stereo because I want it." "Well, that's wrong." "Why?" "In my mind, in my construct, in my truth, it's okay. The guys who hit the Twin Towers, it was okay." So is there a moral law or isn't there? And that's part of this where the world wants to say, you construct your own up here. You can believe anything you want to up here. But down here, we only have, well, science and facts, okay? But if you don't do this, let's do this. Transcendent moral law says that if you're, do you have a son or daughter? Daughter. Your house catches on fire. You have a dog in there and your daughter. Which one are you going to rescue? Why? Okay? She has value. There is something about human life that has value. And it's put there by God. And I shared this with the eighth graders when we were in Washington, D.C. this year. We went in the Natural History Museum in Washington, D.C. In there, the whole thing is built on evolution. And on a pedestal about this tall, there is a brass thing that looks like a rat. I don't know what it is. But anyway, it's called the first mammal. Okay? And it says, you came from this mammal. So I told the kids, if that's true, then life has no meaning and human life has no value. There's only one problem with that. The same United States government that pays to have that museum there and say that, if you step out of the Natural History Museum and you look up towards Arlington Cemetery, what do you see? One soldier marching in front of three graves at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Why is he there? To honor the value of life of those who have given their lives in defense of this nation. Do you see a dichotomy there? Why does he say that's important? And they have been there since 1930, and you should see the things that those guys have to go through just to be one of those guards. They have to memorize every famous person that's buried in that cemetery and tell you where they are and kind of a history of them. It takes them 5 hours to get ready, their uniform alone, before they step outside the door. It takes them 2 hours just to make sure their shoes are shined before they step out the door. If at any time they disgrace the army or that uniform or what they are doing, they have a plaque inside, their plaque is pulled off, and they are kicked out. And there are a lot of other things they have to go through. Why do we make them go through all these hoops and say that life is precious and there's value to those guys who are dead laying there? And yet 3 miles down the road, we say life has no meaning. And the same thing with those who believe in evolution. They really don't believe, bottom line, because they can't live it when they get home. It's okay in the marketplace, but you go home, you will rescue your daughter before your dog. Why? Because she has value. Human life has value. So you can't live in both worlds. I mean, they do, but you can't philosophically. It doesn't correspond to reality. And that's where the Christian worldview does. It corresponds to and answers all questions of life and reality. Now, Buddhism doesn't, Hinduism doesn't, and any other major religion in the world doesn't. But Christianity does, which is why it belongs in both houses, both sides of this upper and lower spectrum, because it can answer all of these questions down here. And part of that is intelligent design. Okay. Now I'm really late. All right. Fine-tuning of the universe. The Earth is finely tuned to have all its needs to survive and allow for this discovery of the Creator. The following parameters of a planet, its planetary companions, its moon, its stars, galaxy, must have values falling within narrowly defined ranges for physical life of any kind to exist. And I have a list right here from scientists. There are 154 factors that have to be in place for this world to exist like it is. From stars to cosmic winds to meteors to things I don't even know about, nova and supernovas and all this stuff. Okay, and we're going to take a look at that real quick right now.